I've got a reading for us, a little bit longer than normal, but bear with me. It connects to our story for all ages and is relevant to my sermon as well. It's an excerpt from a book called A Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold. We reach the old wolf in time to watch a fierce green fire dying in her eyes. I realized then and have known ever since that there was something new to me in those eyes, something known only to her and to the mountain. I was young then and full of trigger itch. I thought that because fewer wolves meant more deer, that no wolves would mean hunter's paradise. But after seeing the green fire die, I sensed that neither the wolf nor the mountain agreed with such a view. Since then, I have lived to see state after state extirpate its wolves. I have watched the face of many a newly wolfless mountain and seen the south-facing slopes wrinkle with a maze of new deer trails. I have seen every edible bush and seedling browse, first to anemic destitute and then to death. I have seen every edible tree defoliated to the height of a saddle horn. Such a mountain looks as if someone had given God a new pruning shears and forbidden him all other exercise. In the end, the star bones of the hoped-for deer herd, dead of its own too much, bleached with the bones of the dead sage, or molder under the high-lined junipers. I now suspect that just as a deer herd lives in mortal fear of its wolves, so does a mountain live in mortal fear of its deer. And perhaps with better cause, for while a buck pulled down by wolves can be replaced in 2 or 3 years, a range pulled down by too many deer may fail of replacement in as many decades. So also with cows. The cowman who cleans his range of wolves does not realize that he is taking over the wolves' job of trimming the herd to fit the range. He has not learned to think like a mountain. Hence, we have dust bowls and rivers washing the future into the sea. We all strive for safety, prosperity, comfort, long life, and dullness. The deer strives with its supple legs, the cowman with trap and poison, the statesman with pen, the most of us with machines, votes, and dollars, but it all comes to the same thing, peace in our time. A measure of success in this is all well enough and perhaps is a requisite to objective thinking. But too much safety seems to yield only danger in the long run. Perhaps this is behind Thoreau's dictum, "In wildness is the salvation of the world." Perhaps this is the hidden meaning in the howl of the wolf, long known among mountains, but seldom perceived among men. And that ends our reading. And the book comes from 1949. God, goddess, mother, source, love, mystery, truth, muse, beauty, law, science, infinity. These are a few of the ways that some of our Unitarian Universalist and Unitarian Universalist ancestors describe their relationship with nature. Their relationships with nature could be described as monotheist, mystical, polytheist, poetic, feminist, cosmic, scientific. But for each of them, even amid all of their theological diversity, nature was a higher power in some manner. What is nature for you? Maybe I've already named your relationship with nature, or I have not. Maybe your relationship with nature is still under exploration or yet to emerge. But what I get us all thinking about today is that nature can have a place across the theological spectrum. UU congregations often struggle with their theological diversity. Rather than us standing in our theological silos, keeping score about how many times I was represented or how many times to endure your perspective being represented. So rather than doing that scorekeeping of how often each of our theological perspectives gets represented, maybe we'd be better off zeroing in on those places where we do agree and celebrate the things that we have in common. So in this five-way Venn diagram here, I'm going to contend that nature is there in the middle where the A, B, C, and D all connect. So rather than standing in the A, B, C, D out there on the edge and throwing mud at one another because there's not enough theism or there's not enough atheism or what have you, I'm suggesting maybe nature can be a common theological meeting place for us. It's a place where theists and non-theists, mystics and humanists, poets and ecologists can all agree that nature is worth honoring and adoring, saving and preserving. So whatever wherever you may be theologically, whatever your relationship with nature may be, it can potentially be a place where we can come together and agree that nature is special, yet still each do so in our own way as we collectively honor our seventh principle to respect the interdependent web of all existence of which we are part. I want to address first the term higher power and why I'm using that today, and then I'm going to move on to Thoreau and Aldo Leopold as examples of nature adorers. The term higher power became popularized in our culture through Alcoholics Anonymous and other 12-step programs. And for many of the folks in 12-step programs, higher power is for them a synonym for God. But that has more to do with the fact that we live in a majority Christian culture where most people in our culture think of something greater than themselves as God. However, higher power need not mean that. And in 12-step programs and elsewhere, it can also refer to love, to service, to music, to art, science, nature, universe, humanity. In other words, anything that gives you some kind of a sense of wonder or awe or purpose. So my use of the term higher power today was a purposeful choice, because it accurately describes my own relationship with nature. I'm comfortable using that term. But additionally, it works because it is a concept that can hold multiple theological viewpoints at once. So I'm going to use the term higher power here today to refer to nature as something greater than the self. So I'm not necessarily implying theistic connotations, but I think it can be theistic as well. And I think that when we live beyond our selfish interests, when we live with ethical purpose, with mindfulness, when we do our best to live that seventh principle, then I think what we're doing is honoring something that's greater than ourselves. For some people, that might have a divine dimension. For others, it might not. If you could head to the next slide, Teresa. So one of our Unitarian ancestors who expressed a love for nature as a higher power was writer, poet, and philosopher Ralph Waldo Emerson. And he did so from a theist perspective in a particular way. For Emerson, religion was found at the intersection of nature and our spirits and words. So nature and our and spirits and our words, when the three of those converge, that's religion in his mind. So Emerson believed that our spirits, each of our individual spirits, came from a common, he called it an oversoul, a spirit of the universe. Here's a quote from him about that. Man is conscious of a universal soul within or behind his individual life, wherein, as in a firmament, the natures of justice, truth, love, and freedom arise and shine. This universal soul he calls reason. It is not mine or thine or his, but we are its. We are its property and men. And in the blue sky in which the private earth is buried, the sky with its eternal calm and full of everlasting orbs is the type of reason. That which, intellectually considered, we call reason, considered in relation to nature, we call spirit. Spirit is the creator. Spirit hath life in itself. That's the end of the quote. So Emerson is saying that our spirits use their own reason. We could also perhaps use the word intuition, right? There's an intuitive reason inside of us that comes from the universe. And as we seek from the inside to understand the universe, symbols come to us, and we attach words to those symbols because we want to be able to describe our experience of the universe and of nature. So searching and striving to understand nature from the inside is language and it's religion. That is what our spirituality, Emerson said, is grounded in. And in doing so, in our internal spirit's seeking, that relationship and that experience with nature puts us in touch with the universe, with the oversoul, with the ideal above, with the spirit of nature, with the divine. But more than that, it also puts us in touch with all other spirits and all other people. So each of our individual souls are also connected to the oversoul, the universal soul, he says. So therefore, we are all connected as well. So the divine is the universe, and it's out there. It's also within us, and it's in each other as well. So theologically, we could refer to Emerson as a pantheist, because for him, he made no distinction between nature and the divine. They were one and the same. So his God, his theist beliefs, is not in an anthropomorphic human-like God that's out there somewhere. Rather, the divine is the universe, and the universe is also in us. So Emerson was a nature adorer and a theist because, in his mind, the two of those were identical and inseparable. To love nature was to love the divine, and to love the divine was to love nature. Let's transition to someone coming from a non-theist perspective. And I'm going to use the author of our reading, Aldo Leopold. He wasn't a Unitarian or a Universalist, but I've included him because he is very much everyone's ecological ancestor. He was a professor at the University of Wisconsin in the first half of the 20th century, and he's best known for his book, A Sand County Almanac, that was published right after he died in 1949. And his writings had a huge impact on how our entire culture views land and wilderness and wildlife. Leopold called for a redesign of our relationship with nature and land. He suggested that extending ethics to our relationships with nature was a, quote, an evolutionary possibility and an ecological necessity. And his turning point came when he was employed by the Forest Service, and he was doing what everyone in the Forest Service did then, and, well, a lot of them now, too. He was out happily shooting wolves and mountain lions because they were pests. They were destroyed economic resources that were valuable and useful to humans, namely livestock and deer. But on one particular day, when watching a wolf die, Leopold had an epiphany about nature and how humans had been making mistaken understandings of nature and of animals and of our place within nature. So he promoted the belief that instead of dominating nature in ridding it of the things that seemed less useful from a human-centered point of view, Leopold asserted that all the elements of a biotic community are necessary and valuable and interdependent. All the species, whether a predator or a prey, a plant, an insect, a bacteria, a fish, a mammal, etc., whether it's useful to humans or not, all of them contribute to a healthy, natural environment. And more than that, the well-being of each one of those species depended on the health of the entire ecosystem, just as the ecosystem depends on each species. He wrote, "A thing is right," I have this quote here on the screen, "a thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community. It is wrong when it tends otherwise." Leopold was influenced by Emerson and others like Emerson in seeing nature as alive and worthy of respect on its own terms. And he articulated a spiritual relationship with nature that borrowed from Emerson's emphasis on intuition. Here's a quote from him on that. "Possibly in our intuitive perceptions, which may be truer than our science and less impeded by words than our philosophies, we realize the indivisibility of the earth, its soil, mountains, rivers, forests, climate, plants, and animals. And we respect it collectively, not only as a useful servant, but as a living being. Vastly less alive than ourselves in degree, but vastly greater than ourselves in time and space. A being that was old when the morning stars sang together, and when the last of us has been gathered unto his fathers, will still be young." So Leopold invited us, and I use this phrase that he coined in his reading, he invited us to think like a mountain. And what he meant by that is we needed to think beyond our short-term, human-centered economic self-interests. And instead, we needed to think about the long-term ecological interests of the planet and all of the life that shares the planet with us. Now, what he had to say was not just spiritual mumbo-jumbo from a tree-hugger, as environmentalists are sometimes derogatorily called. What he said was a spiritual and scientific truth. As we saw in our video story for all ages, when we think like a mountain, we can find out that wolves can change rivers. The concepts or the terms religious humanism and religious naturalism, they weren't in use at the time Leopold was alive, but based on his writings and what his family later said of him, I think it'd be an accurate description of his theology. I think we could call him a religious humanist or a religious naturalist. So for him, nature was a source of awe, a source of beauty and wonder. And nature was a colossal life form, greater than any other. And it's our home whose beings deserved respect for their role in nature's systems. Yet his adoration and his admiration of nature did not move towards divine explanations and theism. He remained a non-theist, even as he loved nature in spiritual and ecological terms, and he believed that intuition was a source of authority, of spiritual and ecological authority. And he encouraged all of us to use that same source and understanding ecological truth. So on the one hand, we have Emerson, a philosopher and a pantheist of the 19th century. On the other, we have Leopold, an ecologist and religious humanist from the 20th century, but both viewed nature as a higher power in their own way. Reverence for the earth, environmentalism, and concern for the interdependent web of which we are part. That's for theists, it's for pantheists, polytheists, artists, humanists, ecologists, and on that list could go. A love of nature is something that you use have in common. Our love for nature and our environmental values transcend, but also embrace our theological diversity. So I picked this on purpose, this depiction of the seven principles on purpose, because I love how the seventh principle is serving as the boundary that's holding our moral universe together. The values we share, which include a love for nature, are in my mind far greater and far more important than the religious views that we don't have in common. And so may we all think like a mountain for nature's sake. May we think like a mountain with a deep and with a broad sweeping view of ecology and nature and of our place in the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. So I encourage all of us to consider what we can do to honor nature and her creatures this day and every day. Just like the wolves of Yellowstone, each of us affects how the river flows. Nature is waiting for us.